You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
We're really pleased today to have as our guest Gary Anderson, who's the director of MSU's School of Social Work, and Denise Busley of Grand Traverse Pie Company, and an advocate for children. And one of her passions working in the Traverse City area has been having the genuine and candid conversations that are so difficult for communities, for families regarding child sexual abuse. This is a difficult topic, I think, for all of us because it's been sort of caught up in the Penn State situation. Right. And it would be a real mistake to connect the issues of child sexual abuse and athletics. And even though what's brought it to the fore has been the situation involving someone who was a former coach at Penn State. And so one of the great powers, I think, of athletics is that that whatever happens, it tends to get bigger attention, whether it was the core issue or not. And so I thought it would be a good chance to sort of step back for a moment and talk to the two of you a bit about the issues of child sexual abuse and in our approach, see something, say something, sort of do something as the MSU approach to this. Sort of what you think about what we should know about it, and sort of, again, take it out of the Penn State situation and right. what's been reported in the newspaper, but down to the facts and what you know as a researcher, and Denise, what you know as a community activist.
Well, to say that one of the things that we know is around the prevalence of child sexual abuse. When we think of the numbers of perhaps one out of four girls and one out of six boys being sexually abused in some way, shape, or form, those numbers are frightening. And as we look at the statistics, we see that that number hasn't changed much over the years, that it's pretty steady. Particularly in Michigan, the number of substantiated reports of child sexual abuse have remained about the same over the years. So we know this is not a necessarily uncommon experience. What's less common is the conversation and really mobilizing society. One of the things that I did early on in my career as a social worker is I was a child protective service worker for the state of Michigan, which meant that those reports came to my desk and I made those home visits. And I talked to usually the men who were the abusers and then to the children who were the victims. And once you have that experience, it sticks with you. So I think the prevalence and then the impact on the victims in our communities is the thing that really remains a crucial topic for us today.
Well, I first became involved with this issue 3 years ago. Actually, I mentored children for the last 11 years and then became aware of foster youth and the plight of these kids just in that system and then how devastating it is when they age out and how they basically get dropped. So I've been involved in that for a long time. But 3 years ago, I really began to understand the prevalence that is child sexual abuse. You know, the one in four, the one in six, and you can hear those numbers, but it doesn't really hit home until you really allow it to. So my feeling is the thing that has happened, this devastation through Penn State, is we've seen it before. We've seen it with the Catholic Church, and we've seen it with the Boy Scouts, and we've seen it with other institutions. And I think the most amazing opportunity with the NCAA and institutions of higher learning is that, you know, we have the leadership there to really help the public understand, you know, this pandemic. It is a pandemic. And so I think it's an amazing opportunity for universities to step forward and to be leaders in getting the access of information, you know, available to
Gary
to
and I had an opportunity to sit down in my office with a couple other staff members and really talk through the issues. And I think it's an uncomfortable topic to talk about. And I think that's part of our problem. Anything that we go through in intercollegiate athletics, the first issue before you can even step forward is to identify that there is a problem. And as Gary presented some materials and we talked through some issues and we asked questions, that came very strong to the forefront. I then look at you, Denise, as how socially do we open up the door and make this something that we as adults, we as leaders, have an opportunity to make it something that can be discussed. So now we know the problem, but mm-hmm. now let's discuss it, and
right.
then you can lead to resolution and correction.
You know, I've kind of happened upon this. I think this issue happened upon me, and I'm not afraid to talk about it. And I think the interesting thing is I've had a lot of people say, well, people are going to think it doesn't happen in a beautiful spot like Traverse City. I have never heard that, not mm-hmm. once in my 3 years of talking to people, and I've talked to countless people. Mm-hmm. If you stand in the grocery line behind me long enough, we'll talk about this issue. And nobody, not one person ever has said, gosh, I don't think that's a problem, or shied away from the conversation. My feeling is that it comes from the attitude of the person who initiates the conversation. Mm-hmm. In other words, I really believe this must be talked about. The silence is what is throwing children under a bus every single day. It's right. our lack of the ability to talk about it as adults mm-hmm. that is the issue here. So for me, it just, the conversation flows out of me. I've never had a problem talking about this issue because every time I open my mouth, I feel like I could save a child. What greater opportunity is that to talk about it and put our own fears kind of, you know, behind us? So I think it's just the willingness to start the conversation.
Well, there is something about the intentionality, because I agree yes. that if we leave it up to human nature, most of us would tend to believe that people are basically good and either respecting families' privacy.
I also think people are conflict avoiders.
Yes. Definitely.
By nature.
Definitely.
And so this is conflict.
Yeah, so there has to be, I guess the thing that's been reinforced for me is the need for intentionality about this. Mm-hmm. So for our summer camps, the School of Social Work has some summer camps, athletics, other academic, the fact that we build this into our conversation with our camp counselors, and we mm-hmm. build it into our conversation with the many young people who are at MSU in the summer. We have to build it into our curriculum. We have to make sure that when we're training social workers and really a whole range of students, that they start that conversation while they're in school. Mm-hmm. And so we have to kind of set that norm here. And then also with faculty and staff, what we found is that students who they're away from home for the first time and they're in a safe environment, they really do feel comfortable, they're happy here at MSU, they're making connections. And all of a sudden, they're remembering things, or they're identifying that something was not appropriate, or mm-hmm. They're troubled. And that comes out in the papers that they write, the conversations mm-hmm. they have in class. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we find ourselves with this opportunity and responsibility to be helping young people who have discovered some of the conditions that they've been living under have been so harmful. But that happens when they're here. So this kind of intentional work, because human nature would be pleased just to tell me everybody's nice and good.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And this is MSU Today. You're listening to a conversation on the child sex abuse pandemic between Michigan State University President Luanna Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, MSU School of Social Work Professor Gary Anderson, and ardent child advocate Denise Busley, who is an MSU alumna and co-founder with her husband, Mike, of Grand Traverse Pie Company.
The neat thing that can come out of the devastation which is surrounding the individuals and in the way that press has labeled Penn State is that if we can have these conversations and recognize that people are harmed in ways that may not be as evident, because most of the people who have been abused in some form are functioning adults. Mm-hmm. It's not
That's
like
right.
being shot where the people can see a wound,
right.
or it's not necessarily the kind of abuse where the people come with a black eye or a broken arm or things that we become horrified mm-hmm. about. These are much more invisible wounds, but still extraordinarily impactful on particularly young children and the way in which they tend to develop relationships. And so it's easy for us to get sort of agitated about somebody with the black eye or the
right.
broken
mm-hmm.
arm.
And
we
as
still,
we talked, Gary,
yeah.
most of those wounds came from people they know and people
right.
they're
right.
very close to.
Yeah, the statistics are that over 90% of the perpetrators are known to the victims. About 30 to 40% of those are within their extended family. Mm-hmm. And then there's a bit more who are the other people who are connected to them. But these are not strangers. So you're right. That compounds the impact.
It's difficult.
Well, and I think that the information, too, and one of the things that frightens me about a story like Penn State is Jerry Sandusky is a pedophile. And that is somebody who will perpetrate against multiple children over a lifetime. Most of the children who are perpetrated against, who are raped by an adult, are not. It's not a pedophile. And so we have a lot of information to disseminate to folks that it is a convoluted, complex octopus of an issue. However, the message can be very simple. That's really up to all of us as adults to find out what this looks like and to protect our kids. You know, the message can be very simple, and it can make this whole, you know, issue much less convoluted and complex.
You know, embedded in what you said is something that I think is really important, because I know on the child protective side, the responsibility was almost always on the victim. Mm-hmm. Come forward, tell your story, confess, point the finger.
Right. And the average age is 8.
And so we keep waiting for the victims to kind of take the lead. And I think that, again, the thing that we're talking about here at Michigan State and beyond is shifting that the responsibility for the safety and well-being of children really lies with a whole range of adults and institutions, not putting all this pressure on victims.
I think going back to your data, there's obviously a proportion, mm-hmm, where it involves the immediate family.
Right.
But I think the data would suggest that's not the predominant situation in which this occurs.
It is people who they know, but it's not necessarily
parents. The immediate family. So we often define this as either a stranger or a parent.
Right. It's either incest or this monster.
Right. Monster. Right. But really what the data would suggest that it is this broad middle.
Right.
And in that process, there's a sort of a conditioning, for lack of a better term, of children that it doesn't start out with this sort of sexual attack. It starts out in a conditioning process. I think one of the things that is really good for parents to understand who care deeply about their children is how and what are some of the signs for the conditioning, maybe of someone in their extended family or the people who they are trusting with, mm-hmm, their children in a variety of situations. What might they look for that could be more protective of their children or your sister or brother or other things that could stop this and sort of move the numbers down a little bit more effectively than just putting a billboard up or saying, gee whiz, this isn't awful.
Right. I think the other part embedded in what you said is that there's also this middle ground in terms of what constitutes child sexual abuse, because there is rape and there's intercourse and sexual penetration, but there's also a whole range of voyeurism and, mm-hmm, exhibitionism and lots of other behaviors, exposure to pornography, touching in inappropriate ways, exposing children to sexual situations that they shouldn't be exposed to. So again, it's to be attentive that there's something in between kind of rape and nothing. There's this And I think a couple of the issues that I would, if I was talking with parents about, first one would be respect for boundaries, that people need to respect their children's bodies and that relationship, so that their affection is one thing, but there's kind of an over-affection, a privacy, a soliciting, an over-attentiveness to children. And I know it's a complicated thing because, again, just like we can't point to the monster, there are these signs. And I know that as a man who works with children and has children, there's a sense of, oh, no, well, you know, can I hug my kids? You know, but there's this point where there's an excessiveness and a lack of boundaries and an over-attentiveness that can be an alert.
And Denise, I know as you've talked to families in which they've now recognized that some of these things have happened to their kids,
mm-hmm,
oftentimes they sort of had this gut feeling that it wasn't quite right.
Almost all the time.
So that the parents, mm-hmm. the adults around, could feel a little uncomfortable about the way in which people were physically interacting with their mm-hmm. children. And it just didn't feel right.
Right.
You know, but it wasn't something that you could put your finger on. It, mm-hmm. it wasn't a definite thing, like mm-hmm. like hitting. It was just not feeling really good about
yeah.
it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the relative, the cousin, who seems to be gathering attention in ways that you think, I don't mm-hmm. know about that.
Right.
And I think one of the real messages about protecting kids is sort of go with your gut instincts
Absolutely.
On some of this.
Absolutely. I think that the interesting thing about this issue is we have a tendency as adults to sacrifice our children for the adult relationship. In other words, I know this person. I've always trusted this person. I like this person. But yet there's something that doesn't really feel right. And I'm not really sure. And so, gosh, I'm just going to let my child around this person. I mean, it kind of goes against.
But there's also, I think, a lesson to be learned in part of this, if I understand your mm-hmm. research and your experience correctly, that oftentimes if the parent, the adult, simply says, you know, Mary, Johnny, whatever the kid's name is, it's really uncomfortable. We'd really
yes.
like for him to be a part or her to be a part of your baseball team, or we'd really like them to be, but they're a little uncomfortable mm-hmm. with as much attention. Would you mind? You know,
exactly.
Would you mind sort of, you know, being able to respect my child's sort of sense
Absolutely.
Of unease?
Well, yep. I think 80% – when we know that 80% of this, you know, of a child being harmed is happening one adult on one child. So if we teach a child their own body boundaries, it's really teaching our children human sexuality. So at the core of this, I think it's kind of – it's a cultural shift. That's taboo. You know, yeah. we don't talk about these things with our children, which is a little crazy. I mean, if you don't teach your child about their own sexuality, someone else will. And so, you know, part of it is just educating what is a healthy boundary to have. What do we do with our feelings? You know, teaching boys as they reach puberty, you know, what do you do with those feelings? You know, it's really opening up our education system, not only through our public schools, but also internally in our homes, talking about this issue.
And I think that's an important long-term crusade. But there's a really sort of a simple piece,
yes.
which is talking to the young right. people around you. And if they're a little uncomfortable,
absolutely.
Even though they don't quite know why they're
absolutely.
Uncomfortable, and you're a little uncomfortable even though you don't quite, you know, you just try to redefine the situation. And
sure.
I think your
absolutely.
Experience, you know, the experience that the research I've seen, and you need to be my research expert, would suggest that those simple actions
right.
Have a way of having enormous deterrence.
They do.
On things getting to a point where they are more harmful to the child.
Right, because a lot of this is just, again, kind of reasserting proper boundaries, making sure that communication is clear, reinforcing basic safety. And we know that when we bring child sexual abuse to light, that serves to be a preventative and protective to children. It's why the law in the state of Michigan says that the standard is suspicion of child abuse or neglect. It's not that you have to have solid proof to call and then ask a report to other people. And embedded in your comments, President Simon, are also not only attentiveness to the adult, but the attentiveness to the child's behavior.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so that piece about paying attention to what's going on with the kids, too, and how they're behaving. And so much of this is because we don't listen to our kids. And then the kids also feel kind of guilty and ashamed, or it's been communicated that this is a secret.
Right.
So we particularly have to be listening and attentive
right.
to their needs.
But sometimes they just sort of are reluctant to go again.
Right.
Right.
You know, you say, well,
that's,
gee whiz.
Pay
you
attention
know,
to that.
You know, whatever. You
well,
know.
And I think,
you
know, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Like, the message right. can be really simple. And the message is, if your child is uncomfortable, that you should respect those boundaries of your child, and instead of labeling it as, oh, this child's being defiant, or or he'd rather go to his friend's house, or whatever it might be, that actually that is one of the red flags That is one of the things to pay attention to as an adult.
This is MSU Today with Russ White on AM 870 WKAR.
And this is MSU Today. You're listening to a conversation on the child sex abuse pandemic between Michigan State University President Luanna Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, MSU School of Social Work Professor Gary Anderson, and ardent child advocate Denise Busley, who is an MSU alumna and co-founder with her husband Mike of Grand Traverse Pie Company.
Nancy and I have three children, and we speak very frequently, especially with our youngest, but as our older two kids went through, we did as well with them. And you say they're fortunate because they have two parents that ask questions, right. And there's many children that don't have. They may come from a single parent home, and the single parent is working hours that don't provide those opportunities. Where does that protection come from in those children's lives? How where's the advocate, and where do we talk about that kind of a case?
Well, I think, Mark, your point is a really good one, because certainly the primary responsibility in place for these protective factors is in the home with your parents. But there's also your extended family. There's our school systems. There are all the other ways in which kids connect to society. So that's why this has got to be a message that's not just aimed at parents, or not just aimed at any one sector of our society. Because we need, and also even when you've got the two parents who are having the conversation, you really need to be backed up by other parts of our society. They're sending positive messages that support children's self-esteem and that also help educate and provide some attentiveness to their safety.
And I think, as Denise mentioned, it's also the responsibility of leaders not to sit back idly, whether it be at the Boys and Girls Club, it be at clubs that are or sports
that's
that are competing
exactly
on
right.
campus. Denise, when you're in line, are you talking about education, identification, or enforcement?
I think that we're at the see it phase. I think we're just really right now as a society looking at this and understanding that it's an issue that we all need to be concerned about. So, I think this is happening at a good time because there are a lot of resources out there to help people.
Right.
As you look at these national cases that have come forward, does that make it easier or more difficult to talk about?
Oh, I think it makes it much easier.
Much easier.
I mean, I really do, because it's hard to ignore.
Mm-hmm. However, we've seen other, terrible things happen in society with a certain amount of outrage and energy that dissipates. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the goals, is that we build this into our enduring social systems and into the ways in which families conduct their business as a family, so that right now I think these are – one of the sad benefits is that it brings attention. But if we don't intentionally build some things into the way that we operate as universities and schools and families, some of these lessons are going to get lost, and we're going to be having this kind of conversation again in a couple of years.
I think one of the things that the NCAA was attempting to do with the creation of this foundation was to treat some of the funds as an endowment, so that we could have this.
Great.
We could have a persistent attention to this issue, because I think Gary, you're right. I mean, this is not the first high-profile case. It got a bit more attention, I think, than it would have otherwise, because it was associated with a prominent university. But if you take the church, the Boy Scouts, other very prominent organizations, there are people who remember it, but by and large, it goes off to the next crisis.
Right.
And this is going to take a lot of very persistent work on conversations that have to be clear about being able to see it in order to say something and do something. Mm-hmm. And that prevention, because of looking at these early signs, is extraordinarily important. Because once this thing plays out, in whatever way it plays out, it has potentially very devastating effects on the individual child involved throughout their lifetime. But there are these simple things that if we can get them activated as a part of our community can prevent a lot of this, just like not smoking prevents
Absolutely.
A lot of cancer.
Right.
Doesn't prevent all of it, but it prevents a lot of cancer. So there's a sort of a mm-hmm. an equivalent of this, I think, in the general child sexual abuse area.
Yeah, I think that prevention is one of those topics. It's hard to get your hands on, but in this case, prevention, response, and treatment are interlinked in an even more powerful way, because we know that if you can intervene and stop somebody from sexually abusing a child, that that's going to save either more victimization or future victims. And we also know that a certain number of people who are sexually abused then, as they become adults, also sexually abuse other children as part of a response to what's happened to them. So the link between prevention and treatment here is very strong, and it makes to invest in both that prevention and treatment effort makes a lot of sense.
Right. But going back to Denise's comment, and I think, you know, what Mark would say as a parent, while you would like to save a lot of children, mm-hmm. if you could save one,
absolutely,
then we've made a big difference. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we're yet so hung up in about how we're going to save a lot of children mm-hmm. and develop the programs to do that, that we forget about the simple actions to save one.
Right.
And that's part of, I think, the community message of the programs that Denise is running in
right.
in Traverse City, is even though, you know, we can't do everything, mm-hmm. if there's one way that because you're attentive to a child, that you divert the path.
That's right.
Then
right.
we may not have solved the problem. We may not have gotten after the individual who was the other adult who was involved, but we will have saved a child.
Absolutely.
And this is about saving children. It's not necessarily about the criteria for success being we've arrested 17 people.
Absolutely.
I agree completely.
Absolutely. And I think just having the conversation, this, what we're doing right now, is huge. It's huge because it's allowing other people to come forward and talk.
Right.
Becky Francis was just in the news, the head coach, women's basketball coach at Oakland University, was abused by her own father from age 4 through the 7th grade. Powerful, powerful article written about her. And, you know, she's joining forces with Aaron Marin, I believe is her name. Aaron's Law actually was just passed in Michigan. So this is starting to get attention. And when the victims feel like they can come forward and free their soul that's been trapped since they were a child, that just goes a long way to helping a multitude of kids.
And I think that what you've described, too, is really doing both. That
yes.
We need to change societal attitudes, conversation, policies, laws, procedures, mm-hmm. but each kid matters.
Absolutely.
Each kid matters.
Yeah, when I was a child protective service worker knocking on that door, at that moment there was one child who was not safe and was facing a horrendous life at that moment. And at that point in time, that was enough. That was meaningful enough and important enough to do that one right. knock on the door.
But you also know the stories of just being able to say to a relative, you know,
yeah.
That, you know, because the kid, you know, going with the kid and saying, look, you know, Mary or Joe really loves you, but this is really uncomfortable.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, we want to do something else.
Yep.
Right.
You know, that still has a huge impact on that child and maybe other children down the road if you look at the
I agree completely.
Okay.
And from it turning from that being okay to do to that being expected. We're expected to do that. We're expected to protect our children in that way.
Well, hopefully this conversation will open up the conversations for others to take place following. And my three children are the reason I stop at Grand Traverse Pie every week on the way home. It's not me. It's the children.
It's for the children.
It's for the children.
True love.
And hopefully that others will be able to connect with people like Gary, researchers across the country. There are lots of websites. Mm-hmm. But also to see themselves as being Denise Busley of their community, that Pied Piper that we need to begin the conversations.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much for having us.
Conversation provides comfort. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was a discussion on child sex abuse between Michigan State University President Luanna Simon, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, MSU School of Social Work Professor Gary Anderson, and Child Advocate Denise Busley. To hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
Turn it up, a little bit higher. Radio, turn it up, so you know. Radio.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
And here's President Simon and A.D. Hollis with MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman. Here's President Simon on MSU Today.
Well, it's really our pleasure to welcome Scott Westerman, Executive Director of the MSU Alumni Association.
This really, for us, President Simon, has been the year of the network at the MSU Alumni Association. We've naturally had some great success in being able to grow membership in the association, but we've been able to touch more lives in person this year than I think we ever have before. The latest example, of course, is we had one of our members of our homecoming court, which the MSU Alumni Association sponsors, accompany Trustee Foster on a trip to South Africa with the express assignment of blogging about the trip. And it was truly a life-changing experience for Janelle Goodwill, who is an African studies major, but had never had that visceral experience of actually being a part of the changing democracy in South Africa. They've only been at this thing for 18 years down there, and there's still a lot of the old culture, the apartheid culture, that is alive and well there. And for an African-American student to be able to totally experience that on one hand, but then on the other hand, to be able to go into some of these schools where there are South African kids who may have never, ever considered college, and to have this young woman be a role model to say, look, here's what you can do if you get good grades and study hard, was a really magical experience for her. So these are the kind of things that are happening all the time at the Alumni Association. It's one of the reasons why I have the best job in the world.
How much of the connection of the Alumni Association with a student while they're on campus studying, being a student, mean once they leave and have that association back to the Alumni Association? It's from my perspective, the philosophy of you're a student, you graduate, you become a member of the Alumni Association is antiquated. And I've observed where we've really started to connect with the kids while they're here, and then that reward coming back for continued involvement with alumni events seems to be much, much stronger than in the past.
The whole process of becoming a Spartan and your connection with the Alumni Association actually happens before you even make the decision to come here. Our alumni are very heavily involved with Jim Cotter's admissions team and volunteering at college fairs. Mm-hmm. So that's probably the first time that you would see somebody who's actually been a product of this institution. The second step is when they make the decision to come here. And that's when our alumni clubs in our markets get involved, and we host welcome picnics, mm-hmm. where we touch two special demographics. We touch the incoming freshmen, but we also invite those rising high school juniors who are making those decisions in their hearts at that moment. So they get a chance to actually interact with people in the communities of all ages, mm-hmm. Folks that have had successful careers, but also recently graduated alums who are there to tell their Spartan stories. On day one, when they get on campus, the first people that they see when they move in are alumni. This past fall, we had over 300 Spartans that came back to the dorms where they lived to don their welcome T-shirts and to unload those minivans. So the first people that the parents talk to are people who have had that experience in that dorm. And the kids that say, hey, I'm moving to the sixth floor of Wonders Hall, what's it like to be up there? They'll talk to somebody who actually lived there. Then comes the Student Alumni Foundation, and that's that name has always been of some confusion for folks because it doesn't really define what we do there. We're in the process of, as you well know, evolving beyond the very important work we do in the student sections for you to become the central pivot for leadership development among all of the student-run organizations at Michigan State. We work very closely with Dr. Maybank and Student Life to help provide that leadership experience. We do the most. We facilitate the most internships on campus at the Student Alumni Foundation. So by the time you leave Michigan State, you already have had 4 years of experience and exposure to alumni. So what we hope it will be is a foregone conclusion that you'll want to stay connected when you get into the real world. And that's where the Spartan Pipeline comes in. This is a new initiative that we've been piloting for the last 6 months. Wherever you are in the Spartan Nation, if you're moving to a new city, if you come to the Student Alumni Foundation website, there's a place that you can check in, the Spartan Pipeline. And you can say, my name's Mark Hollis. I'm moving to Chicago. I'm going to be working for Procter & Gamble. I want to figure out where I should be living and where the local place is to do game watches.
Yeah.
Well, immediately when you press that send button, it goes to a designated hitter on our local clubs there whose response is within 24 hours. And they're there to welcome you and to give you a personal invitation to come with them to an MSU alumni event. Because we live in a world now where people want to be invited. We just don't seem to be naturally wired to want to go out and connect. And what we've discovered through our experiences with the D.C. Spartans and with the Spartans up in San Francisco is that when you get to a new town, you're looking for a friend mm-hmm. who wants to invite you to be part of something. We want to make sure that something is the Spartan Nation.
Yeah. Just listening to you, if you're at Career Day at an elementary school, and a kid raises his hand and he says, Mr. Westerman, what does your normal day look like? What do you do on your normal day? How do you even begin to answer that question?
There are, well, as you guys know, there are no normal days for people with jobs like ours. And that's what I love about this place. A great story that happened to us this summer was we got a call from a community outside of Seattle. And this was a sixth grade class where a teacher has the expectation that every kid's going to go to college. And this is unique because this is in a community where nobody goes to college. The college, the high school graduation rate is low, and the college attendance rate is even lower. What he does is he makes every student pick a university and do a little piece of research on it. So this young woman, this young sixth grader, reached out to us and said, Michigan State is my school. Would you be willing to send a picture of Sparty, an autographed picture of Sparty? Well, it just so happened that Sue Peterson from our shop was going to be out there anyway. So she swung down, spent an extra day, and went in there. And it was like you had a rock star in the building. She was introduced by this sixth grader who was an introvert, just a burning introvert. And she had everybody's attention in the class. I think probably when we walked in there, maybe one-tenth of the people had ever considered Michigan State. But when we walked out, everybody knew about what the Spartan Magic was all about. That's just one example of the kind of excitement I get every day.
But part of it, I think, for people who enjoy the challenges of universities and see them as just enormous learning experiences for yourself, not challenges in the same way that businesses define challenges, is really being able to enjoy the moments when you interact with folks and then recognize that what you said that you thought was relatively, you know, straightforward, no magic to it, created that magical moment for a student or a young alum who really wants that advice. And so when I was in New York, a couple of young people came up who had interacted with me in a place that I don't really remember. And I'm sure this happens a bit to you. And they remembered something that was that taking time to spend the extra 5 minutes talking to them. And whatever happened in that 5 minutes, which I still don't remember, I must admit, and I know you have those moments as well, and Mark has mm-hmm. those moments, was so meaningful to that individual. I think one of the real secrets about what you've done with the Alumni Association, what Mark tries to do with athletics, we all try to do is make sure that while technology is really important and it's a great way to get information and it is a terrific way to be connected around the world, it is not what defines Michigan State and our Michigan State community or Team MSU. It is about those personal moments.
That is so true. one of the things that I've been speaking a lot about around the country to our clubs this year, of course, is social media.
Yeah.
And the social media message that I leave them with is everything that you do in every communications medium ultimately should lead to the face-to-face encounter, because that's where the research says the real magic happens. I'm a comm arts guy just like you are, mm-hmm. so we've done some study of this, and it turns out that face-to-face allows you to have all of the senses engaged. The nuances of eye contact and the reaction that you can get from people, and almost the unconscious way that you modify your communication so that you're making sure you're connecting with those people. Very hard to do on a tweet, very hard to do on a Facebook or a Twitter post, but those things are all means to the end of getting us together. And kind of the larger way that that happens at Michigan State, of course, is with all of the things that happen in extracurricular activities. When we have these kids who've had that Izzone experience and want to come back 10 years later to the Izzone reunion.
And did a very good job.
And made more noise than
made
the kids
do. Made more noise because they were not texting.
Well, and you saw it when they came back into that practice gym, the hugs that went around, it was like nothing. They had never left. And the diversity of those people, where they've ended up and their backgrounds, are amazing. One of the things that still touches my heart about my first year at Michigan State University was a tailgate that I went to before one of the football games that was put on by the Arab Students Association and the Jewish Students Association. And they had intermingled their traditional foods at this tailgate. So you would start with one dish, one Arab dish, and then one Jewish dish. And these kids it was like they were best friends. And the thing that struck me is something that they said to me. They said, imagine if our two cultures could connect as closely as we have under the Spartan mantra, what could happen with the world? And that really is, when we think about Boulder by Design, which is where you're taking us, is what MSU's mission is all about.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
This is MSU Today, and you're listening to a conversation between MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman, Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis, and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon.
Now, I know that you're struggling a bit with the transition of evening college.
Right, yeah.
And it's one of the challenges that universities face is we do things very, very well. People like what we do, by and large. By and large, the things we do, they're very, very good. So when you make a change in order to move towards a future and different ways of connecting to people, it's often because you're trying to find that next level of connection or that next level of excellence. It isn't because something is bad. And you're struggling a bit with that, with sort of changing evening college, a way we connect with folks in the community. So,
well, you know, about a year ago, Louise Cooley, who is the dean of our evening college, and I sat down and we looked at how well we thought we had evolved the experience to meet the boldness by design imperatives. And we realized that we had a great opportunity to improve the student experience, to do a better job of connecting with our broader communities, and to, for imperative number three, extend our worldwide reach. And what that meant to us was that we had to look at the various things that we were doing and seeing how we could do them in a way that were non-duplicative of necessarily what already was happening in our area, but were also gave us the opportunity to expand them beyond the mid-Michigan area. And it's very hard to do that when you're flying the airplane, because we run evening college very lean. There are two people that handle all of those courses and setting everything up. So what we decided to do, and it was an uncomfortable decision to make, was we decided to limit for the spring term the number of traditional courses we would offer to allow us to develop more educational experiences that we thought would be a closer touch with those imperatives. Mm-hmm. And here are some examples. I mean, one of the things that I hear from all the time from alumni is they say, Professor so-and-so was so great. What I would do to be able to see Walter Adams teach again. Is there a way does that stuff exist? So we're working, of course, with the Provost Office and Dr. Terry Curry to start something we're calling the Evening College Legacy Lecture Series, where we'll come up with a mechanism for identifying a fantastic professor who's a great lecturer and create an opportunity for him to give his best lecture to very enthusiastic students, evening college participants, and his friends and relatives. That'll be something we'll be able to keep forever. Serves multiple purposes. Of course, number one, a great evening college offering for local people to see in person. Number two, it's something that we can disseminate worldwide. And number three, what a great recruiting tool to be able to showcase the best talent that we have on our faculty actually connecting with students in the classroom. That's just one example. Another one is we have a very successful program called Odyssey to Oxford, which fills up, has a waiting list every year. And we wanted to do two things. One is we wanted to offer a second experience like that. But the other piece of that was we wanted to make it affordable because it's an expensive opportunity mm-hmm. to go overseas. So the notion of immersion learning within an hour of East Lansing is something that we're developing where you can get on a bus. There's a place called Columbus, Indiana, for example, which decided 100 years ago to hire the best architects that were alive at that time and build all of their buildings, each one by a different one of these architects. So there's a Frank Lloyd Wright building there. That's within an hour's drive of East Lansing. How great would it be to be able to go with one of our professors of architecture and design to actually see those things in person? We want to be able to offer more immersion learning experiences. And then, of course, there becomes the technology piece. We live in a world where webinars offer a huge opportunity for you to interact with really, really great people in a personal way. And Lisa Wiley Parker, who is our alumni career services person, is partnering with Louise to do more of these webinars. We bring great Spartan talent in who are at the top of their game in business to help you figure out whatever your career is, how you can be better positioned for the next rung on the ladder. So at the end of the day, we're hoping a year from now that we'll not only have more offerings, but we'll be able to do a broader swath of coursework that will have value to Spartans wherever they are in the world.
But it is, I think, if you use that analogy, there are other places that offer, for example, swimming and some other things we were offering under evening college. There was a demand for them. But by this sort of refocusing, we still keep the traditions of evening college, which is having people in the community have access to the best learning.
Well, and tradition is one of our great Spartan ethics. Yeah. When you think about the things that people take away from here that brings them back, it is the tradition. It's one of the fun things we did this year was we inaugurated what we call a virtual tailgate for people that couldn't be mm-hmm. at the games in our sports bars across the country. We actually would take a camera and walk with Coach D and the team from Kellogg to the stadium, march with the band, and then when people – we would have dignitaries come into our alumni tent, we would interview them. Mm-hmm. We didn't even promote this at all this year because it was definitely in beta. But on the last game of the season, without even any promotion, we had 182 people update their alumni profiles, people that we didn't even know about because they happened to stumble across this because it got out onto Twitter. Have you seen this thing? So the whole idea of being able to bring this tradition that we loved while we were here to people that may be in far parts of the world, that's one of the most exciting things we've been working on.
What advice would you give young people who are thinking about a career like yours in terms of skills development? Because there's much more to this than sort of what they envision as the glad handing of old-fashioned alumni right. relations in the 21st century. So what advice would you have about sort of things people should think about, competencies they should be working on?
Well, it's nothing like what people see. It's just like each of your jobs. What people see is just the tip of the iceberg. And it's an interesting point to talk about because we're, with gratitude to you and the Board of Trustees, we're going to be expanding our engagement staff by two people. And everybody that we know has applied for that job. But when I talk to them about what really goes on behind the scenes, only about 20% of our daily existence is that kind of interaction. The other 80% is trying to figure out which programs to prioritize, how to fund them, and to work through the partnerships that are inherent in the academic process, the people that you need to have as your blockers to make sure things are successful. And to make sure you're continuing to listen to the various voices around this institution, the diversity of which makes things very rich, but are also sometimes at odds. So what I tell people when they ask me about careers is the first thing to do is decide, really try and figure out what you love, because you're going to want to there are going to be days when it's going to be tough and you don't want to have to walk away from the job. You want to be able to have the passion to be able to want to stay. The second thing is to, at the very first decision you make, is to figure out what company culture mixes with who you are. And that's why I love being at Michigan State. You all know this. I mean, this is exactly the kind of life, company culture, and people that I want to be with every day. And when you work a seven-day-a-week job like this, that's very, very important. And then the third thing is to make sure that you have the things in your toolbox to be able to make a difference. And a lot of that has to do with researching what the challenges are at the place you want to work, and bring solutions. Because people don't hire, they don't hire jobs. We hire idea people who can help us solve our problems.
Don't you think part of that role, too, is to figure out what it is you're not going to do?
That's the biggest thing, is because there's all kinds of opportunities.
All kinds.
You see that every day. I mean, you'd love to have all of your club sports be varsity sports if you could.
So as you're going through allocating your resources and figuring out your programming, there does have to be a list that you set to the side. These are the things we're not going to do at this
point. Well, and that at the Alumni Association is where our four pillars come in. And every decision we make has to touch either improving MSU's reputation, helping us recruit great people, more broadly and deeply engaging with our alumni, and identifying investor donors to make sure that the Spartan legacy can continue for generations to come. Mm-hmm. That makes the decision a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm. Amazing work and highly respected.
Well, and it's an honor to be with you guys. Thanks for having me.
And I think it's also with both of you. I know there are institutions around the country where there's a good deal of tension between your two offices. But I really do appreciate, I think, the leadership you've both provided. It's sort of the one MSU, one team MSU approach. And while there are always differences of opinion on how best to do that, because you're both creative and talented guys, I think both of you have said in different occasions that it really is as much the capacity to listen as the capacity to generate ideas that turns into great success. And so I think that's
we've never solved a problem with a text.
It's always been
face to face. And I think there's a lesson in that for two guys, not me, because I don't do the tweet deal, but for two guys who are very into the technology, the value of sitting down and simply talking and listening.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
That was MSU Alumni Association Executive Director Scott Westerman talking with Spartans Athletic Director Mark Hollis and Michigan State University President Luanna Simon. There's more online at alumni.msu.edu. And to hear the conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com. Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.